National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. We have a really interesting show for you today. We're going to take a deep look at the oceans of the world and why oceans matter for American national security. Now, you might think that's obvious, that security on the oceans is covered by the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Coast Guard, and that is true, but it's more than that, much, much more. When we study national security, we must consider all four tools of national power. That would be diplomacy, the power of information, military power, and economic power, all of these tools and how they are used. The oceans on our planet are directly connected to not only military power, but also diplomatic and economic power. We'll take a look at the science of studying the oceans, how oceans contribute to the U.S. economy, and how the oceans are vital aspects of our national security in both the hard and soft power arena. We'll also consider some of the advancing science and technology being used today and what might be available in the future to assist the United States in protecting the marine environs. Our guest today is retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet. Rear Admiral Gallaudet is the CEO of Ocean STL Consulting, and he hosts the American Blue Economy podcast. He also serves on a number of boards, including the Directors Council for the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. From 2017 to 2021, Admiral Gallaudet served as the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere and the Deputy National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration Administrator. And from 2017 to 2019, he also served as the Acting Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere and the NOAA Administrator. As the Acting Administrator, he led the agency, which is comprised of 20,000 federal employees and contractors, in managing the nation's fisheries, coastal resources and waterways, weather satellites, the weather services, and environmental research. He was overseeing a $6 billion annual budget, and he led the operations of 18 environmental satellites, 16 oceanographic ships, 9 aircraft, 450 boats, 400 technical divers, 6 supercomputers, and over a dozen laboratories, and several hundred field sites across the country. As the deputy administrator, he led NOAA's blue economy activities to advance marine transportation, sustainable seafood production, ocean exploration and mapping, marine tourism and recreation, and coastal resilience. He also directed NOAA's support to the administration's Indo-Pacific Command Pacific Strategy. He oversaw NOAA's Arctic research, operations, and engagement, and led the execution of NOAA's science and technology strategies for both artificial intelligence, uncrewed systems, cloud data, and citizen science. Prior to serving at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, Admiral Gallaudet served for 32 years in the U.S. Navy, completing his career as the oceanographer of the Navy on the staff of the Chief of Naval Operations. Tim Gallaudet earned a bachelor's degree from the U.S. Naval Academy and master and doctoral degrees from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, all in the field of oceanography. Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, thank you so much for joining us today.
John, it's great to be here.
So where are you sitting this morning for our show?
I am in North Beach, Maryland, a nice little town south of Annapolis, and I have a house right on the western shore of the Chesapeake Bay.
All right. So you're looking at the ocean this morning, is that right?
I'm looking at the bay. It's an estuary, and I haven't been able to get a place to live that's far from the water. It's just salt water is in my veins.
I understand completely. So, Admiral, let me start by asking you some background questions. You majored in oceanography in undergrad at the U.S. Naval Academy, and then you chose to study oceanography for your entire educational path, a master's degree. Doctoral degrees, it really has been the guiding part of your educational background and really your profession. What was the catalyst that drew you into this field of oceanography? And could you explain to our listeners exactly what oceanography does in the world of science?
That's right, John, thanks. Yes, I've been drawn to the ocean ever since I was young. I grew up in Southern California, and I spent a lot of time as a competitive swimmer, training in the ocean, surfing, and just enjoying our beautiful coastline in Southern California. And that just made me want to study it and live near the ocean and do work on the ocean. So that drew me to the Naval Academy more to study and work on the ocean than necessarily to serve in the military. But it's just always been fascinated by the sea, as so many people are drawn to it. And I've never stayed away from it. As I mentioned, I've always lived on the ocean, and I loved and enjoyed working on the ocean.
So for a guy who attended the Naval Academy with the intent of learning more about the oceans, you had a pretty good career retiring as a rear admiral and the oceanographer of the Navy.
I guess it stuck, right? I was really blessed. Of course, all of us who serve like you have in the Navy and came from the Naval Academy, we're only carried by the sailors and people who support us. And that's what happened to me. I just had some wonderful people that carried me along my career, and I just try to pay it forward. And that's why I didn't say no to your request to be on the show.
Okay. So in your opinion, what are some of the most fascinating science-based projects that are happening right now with regard to oceanography?
Right. The ocean is very interesting to me because so much of it is unexplored. We have not even explored 80% of the ocean volume. So there's 80% of the planet that we know nothing about. And the same for the seafloor. The seafloor, we've only mapped not even 50% of the U.S.'s part of the seafloor in the exclusive economic zone. And so that's interesting to me. At NOAA, where I worked at the top ocean agency in the country, we were finding new species every year. And I'm not talking about like little plankton. I'm talking, we actually discovered a new species of killer whale in 2020. Think about that. It's a small killer whale that lives in Antarctica. So the fact that we know so little about our own Earth, and meanwhile, we have mapped the surface of Moon and the Mars to a higher resolution than we know the ocean's own depths. And so I was committed when I worked at NOAA to reverse that. And I led, working with the White House, I was the head of a government agency. We initiated a national strategy and plan to map, explore, and characterize our oceans. And what that means is taking ships with multi-beam sonar and mapping the ocean and discovering new features that have never been seen, like undersea seamounts that are significant for navigation. We had two submarines that have actually crashed and run aground into seamounts within the last 15 years. Very not good, of course, from a national security standpoint. And then also to characterize the ocean, to study it very in detail up close with deep diving remotely operated vehicles and increasingly drones, autonomous underwater vehicles. And all that is still happening right now in a really big way. So that whole national strategy to explore and study the ocean is continuing. And I'm supporting it in my own contractor consulting capacity.
Any other science projects that you're aware of that just are fascinating for you?
Oh, when do you want me to stop? You know, one of the things I think, John, was really fascinating is this new field, and I led an agency strategy to advance it, that's about environmental DNA. So it used to be, the Human Genome Project took over 10 years and nearly two decades, actually, and in total, and millions of dollars to map the human genome. But now, like 23andMe, we can go and find DNA of different species and analyze it just like that with next-generation gene sequencing. And so what's occurring right now for the ocean is we can just scoop up seawater and look at the DNA in it and get a good assessment of the different species that are in a given region, as well as how many of them are the abundance. And that's really fascinating because heretofore, to study the ocean and learn about all the life in it, we would have to take ships with trawls and bring up that sea life and count it and study it under a microscope. And now you can do that with next generation gene sequencing in nearly an instant. It takes a little more time than that, but relatively speaking, it's just fascinating.
So I mentioned in my introduction that you served as the acting administrator for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency, or NOAA, as it's usually referred to. You left that post in 2021. What exactly is NOAA, and why does NOAA matter so much for America's national security and economic vibrancy?
Yes, thanks, John. I just testified in front of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. Chairman Lucas of Oklahoma put forward a bill to make NOAA independent and move it from the Department of Commerce. And one of the things I talked about during the hearing was that NOAA is like NASA, but for the ocean, atmosphere, and environment. And it really should be put on par with NASA in terms of being independent and having the recognition it does, because as the top environmental and ocean agency, NOAA every day is affecting American lives through either national, or an economic security impacts. For example, we help manage with our data and science $200 billion annual fisheries in every coastal area, the Great Lakes, and in our territories. I still feel a strong part of an attachment to the agency. Of course, we have environmental satellites. They're constantly monitoring, 18 of them, weather and space weather, which affects communications, and weather, which affects public safety and economics with respect to agriculture and shipping, et cetera. And as well as ocean, we map the ocean for nautical charts to enable the marine transportation system, which provides 90% of the transport of goods throughout the world. So that's just a small snapshot of what the agency does for Americans. I'd like to say, you know, NASA's great. They perform a wonderful space mission, but their mission does not affect every American life every day. And that holds true for NOAA. That's the impact they have.
So I think if I remember from my intro, is about a $6 billion budget at NOAA every year. Is that enough funding? Does NOAA need more, considering the tremendous economic impact that NOAA's work has on the American economy?
Well, that was the running gunfight I was in during my whole time at the agency, you know, because the prior administration made some big cuts to science agencies, and I was constantly working to get more funding, and Congress did help us with that. And I think the agency now has about $7 billion of funding annually. And at that House hearing, I did testify that more is needed, because I think there's a high return on investment for the American people for what that great agency does.
So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, who is the former acting administrator of NOAA and the oceanographer of the Navy. And we're discussing the oceans of the world and their importance to many aspects of national security and the economy. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. All right, Admiral, let's get into some of the science. Could you explain how climate change is impacting the oceans?
Oh, yes. Climate change is having a significant impact on the oceans. I saw it firsthand. We see that there's warming occurring in different basins, and it's driving fish to migrate north. In Alaska, for example, that's a real problem, because some of the fish stocks are migrating or moving. They're not migrating. They're moving outside of the range of the fishermen's vessels where they have traditionally stayed in port and conducted their vitally economically important missions or work. And so that's a problem. Then you see also this phenomena of acidification of the ocean, where as it absorbs more carbon and becomes more acidic in the water, some species just don't fare well when that occurs, especially certain types of shellfish. So that's having an impact. There are others too. A lot of it's unknown, though. There are a variety of research efforts out there that are working to understand these changes. And a lot of it, there's just a great deal of uncertainty. So the more research we can do, then the better understanding we have of these changes in the ocean, the better we'll be able to adapt to them.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the science projects that you know that are going on to do research on climate impacts on the ocean?
Sure. Well, probably one of the biggest areas of impact is up in the Arctic Ocean. And in fact, I have a kind of a history here. When I first came to the Pentagon as a commander, I helped the Navy stand up a task force climate change, where we were primarily concerned about the Arctic and the fact that ice was melting so quick up there that we just might have more emissions because it was opening up access. It's still occurring. The changes occurring in the Arctic are four times greater than those in the rest of the world. That's how fast it's warming and ice is melting. And then, of course, that creates opportunities and challenges. We may be called to go up there more, but we don't have all the capabilities we need. For example, the Coast Guard is seeking to build more icebreakers, and that's a big budget issue. These are billion-dollar ships, and we don't have many, and some of them are beyond their service life. And so, meanwhile, Russia's up there with 40 or plus icebreakers, and they want to they want to capitalize on these gains and open up that northern sea route where there's natural gas deposits, and they could potentially have a new shipping route to Asia from Europe. And already vessels have been increasing their transits of that region in the summer. So studying the science about that ice change is really important. And NOAA has conducted a number of missions with international partners to study that ice loss and the weather and the ocean changes that are occurring up there.
And I know that that China has also been extremely interested in the fact that the Arctic Ocean is opening up more and more each year. That dramatically cuts down on transit time for the products from their coastal ports over to Europe and the eastern coast of the United States. Have you seen, I mean, from your perspective, having served in these roles, is China investing sort of heavily in the Arctic Ocean operational capabilities as well?
Well, yes, and the fact is they're investing everywhere, and they're not hiding the fact that they want to be the dominant global power. And so you see them not only in the Arctic, and they have called themselves a near Arctic nation. There's no such thing. They really don't have the right to have a permanent presence up there as Arctic nations do. And so, but they're making that claim nonetheless, and you see their incursions and really malign behavior all across the globe. But yeah, that's happening in the Arctic too.
So a little bit more on the science of climate change and how it's impacting the world's oceans. You mentioned the Arctic Ocean. Now, if we move to the land, Greenland, there are some oceanographers that I know that are very concerned about some of the glacial melt coming off of Greenland and also the warming that's happening in Antarctica. From your science-based background, what do you see happening on those two massively huge bodies of ice?
Right. Well, the ice sheets in Greenland, the massive ice sheet, is losing mass at a pretty phenomenal rate. And then, of course, that's happening too, the ice sheets in Antarctica. And that's, of course, we want to know, be able to predict those changes better, because that will contribute pretty significantly to sea level rise. Melting Arctic ice doesn't contribute to global sea level rise because it's in the ocean still right there, right? But this ice mass in Greenland and Antarctica will, because it's not in the ocean right now. And as it melts, it contributes to that overall mass difference of the ocean and therefore the rising of it. I'll make a point here on climate change, though. It's important to know that I just really am upset that the discussion and narrative in the media is so alarmist. Well, actually, it's very polarized. It's you either have alarmists or deniers. And I think a middle of the road approach is really where we want to be, which is objective and science based. So we know that changes are occurring. For example, high tide flooding in America is increasingly occurring around the coast. And some of that's due to sea level rise. Some of that's due to increasing populations and the subsidence of land. And so knowing really specifically what's occurring and being able to predict with certainty what those changes are, I think is what is most important so we can adapt. But I don't think we do ourselves any good by either denying the change and calling it a big conspiracy against big oil or becoming so alarmist to think that it's an existential threat. The term existential threat I would apply probably to Russia right now and the risk of nuclear war. But not climate change. That's something we can get around, and we are already mitigating. And you see our emissions, even the Biden administration has recently changed its accepted emission scenario for the future, which they have projected to actually decrease. So I think a real balanced conversation about climate change is necessary, and that's why I want to contribute here.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. So, Admiral, you covered in some detail, you know, the changes that are happening to the oceans. You did mention, you know, fossil fuels and whatnot. For the oceans, what are the ramifications of these changes? I mean, you have a podcast on the blue economy. That economy relies either completely or at least pretty heavily on a healthy ocean ecology. What concerns do you have about the health of the oceans right now?
Right. Well, okay. Thank you, John. The health of the oceans is important for a number of factors, and the risks are not only due to climate change. You know, there's pollution, for example, a lot of it, plastic pollution, and the main contributor is China and the countries in Asia, and so that's something at NOAA we got ourselves behind. the president signed the Save Our Seas Act when I was the administrator in 2018, and he signed it again in 2020, I believe. And this is the act that authorizes NOAA's program to clean up marine debris and plastic waste and prevent it from occurring in the first place by working with other nations in assisting with their waste disposal programs. So the ocean health in terms of like plastic and the and harm it does harm that does on sea life is important. And it's just not because we care about the national treasure that is marine life, like whales, endangered species like turtles and such. It's because this is a very critical national security issue with partner nations that depend on the ocean for most of their economy. So you think about the Pacific Island countries that are really our primary allies and hedge against China in their backyard. And you're seeing countries like the Solomon Islands who are siding with China now. We're trying to keep Palau in the U.S. sphere and the Marshall Islands, for example. And all these nations depend on the ocean and unhealthy oceans, which are being impacted partially by climate change, but also pollution. That's something that NOAA contributed to in a big way. And I purposely, with the Indo-Pacific Command, worked to use the great power, the soft power you mentioned of our environmental science and ocean health initiatives like coral reef conservation and combating illegal fishing, as well as combating the marine pollution and debris. All of those programs we led at the national level were capabilities and capacities we helped to build in these other nations. And the more we helped them keep their oceans healthy, the more they wanted to be our partner and the less they wanted to partner with China.
So you mentioned some of the plastics and other garbage that's in the ocean. Could you talk a little bit about I guess it's called the Pacific Garbage Patch? What is that, and how big is that?
Well, it conveys this image of a giant trash dump in the ocean, which it in effect is, and it's because the Earth's oceans have circulation patterns that look like large gyres, basically rotating. A giant massive rotating body of water, and the way through a thing called Ekman drift, which I learned as a plebe at the Naval Academy in my oceanography courses, tends to cause when in a rotating body of water, depending on the direction, items on the surface to move towards the center, if you will. That's what's occurring. So you get this distribution of plastic and garbage. Like fishing nets that are discarded and whatnot, all kind of concentrated in the center of the Pacific, and that's what that refers to.
And it's a pretty big collection of that floating garbage in that Pacific gyre, right?
Right. I couldn't tell you the size of it. And the fact of the matter, too, is it's not necessarily just one giant it's distributed, and you see when different islands that are, nearby, you'll see a lot of that trash pile up on some islands like Midway Island in the Pacific Island chain of Hawaii, the Hawaiian Islands, and that's an area we were cleaning up massively every year.
Yeah, I had the same experience when I was the head intel officer for the 3-ship amphibious squadron out of Japan, Amphibious Squadron 11. We worked with the Marines. We did a little bit of an exercise visiting Iwo Jima. And
wow.
I mean, that's hallowed ground for the Marine Corps. Everybody in America probably knows the story of what happened at Iwo Jima, and the amount of garbage that we found on the beaches where the Marines landed in 1945 was just astounding. So we visited there twice during my 2.5 years as the N2, and we did beach cleanups each time we were there to clean those beaches completely because it is kind of hallowed ground. So you mentioned these Pacific or the currents that are in the oceans, the gyres that occur. Some of the scientists that I've been reading lately are very concerned about an ocean current collapse as climate changes and the ocean heating and more fresh water is pumped into the ocean environment. Is this something you are concerned about at all?
Well, were it to occur, yes. But I think some articles that you'll see out there are, again, I think more in the implausible and extreme scenario. Now, remember, just quick education for your audience. In projecting future climate change, the body that does this and writes reports, an international body called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, they have developed these emission scenarios, whereas if we're emitting a lot of greenhouse gases and don't change our way, or if we end up stopping and using more renewables and decreasing our emissions. And depending on the scenario, then you can get these different types of climate change projections. And so collapsing of the ocean currents is typically in those extreme emission scenarios, which I think are very implausible. And in fact, again, I just mentioned that the Biden administration's own Environmental Protection Agency has adopted the less extreme scenario where emissions actually decrease past 2030, which is not in any of this research. A lot of the research, for example, there was a recent article about more home runs in the National League due to climate change, which was an absolute farce of an article because the science behind that was using extreme emission scenarios, and it didn't objectively look at all the different baseball leagues. You know, they didn't look at Japan's league, for example, where home runs have not shown any change. It was one of these articles that people and researchers will go and look at the most extreme possibility, even though it's implausible, just to get a headline. And so there's a lot of that out there. And I have a geophysical science degree. And I think it's a disservice when scientists conduct research and make claims that are extreme to get that are sensational.
So we mentioned throughout this first half hour of our show that one of the responsibilities at NOAA is fisheries management. I have an article in my hand that talks about the U.S. Coast Guard has now stated illegal fishing has surpassed piracy as a global threat. Are you concerned about the fish stocks around the planet and how they're being depleted?
Big time. Absolutely, yes. In fact, that press is really building upon work I was doing at NOAA in 2020. Even during the pandemic, I had I was at the U.S. Coast Guard headquarters where myself, the Coast Guard Commandant, then Admiral Schultz, and then the U.S. Southern Command Commander, a good friend of mine, Admiral Craig Faller. We all spoke at a panel hosted by the Center for Security and International Studies downtown, and we were basically releasing the Coast Guard's strategic outlook on illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. This illegal fishing activity was occurring, is occurring across the globe. China is the main perpetrator, and we are really concerned about the U.S. Southern Command and the Galapagos Islands. And that's why Admiral Faller, overseeing that area of responsibility, the Coast Guard Commandant, and I, we all got together and helped to release that document. And we made that statement probably for the first time that illegal fishing was a national security threat. And so that's been ongoing. And I think, and because, as I said earlier, this is degrading the economies of critical partners in the Southern Hemisphere, in Latin America, and in the Pacific.
So, Admiral, we have to take just a short break to recognize our sponsor. We will be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back. We're back here on National Security This Week. Our guest is Admiral Tim Gallaudet, who was the acting administrator of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. It's a mouthful. And he also retired from the Navy as the oceanographer of the Navy. And we're talking about the importance of the oceans to American national security. Admiral Gallaudet, let's turn to the nexus of the world's oceans and American national security interests a little bit more in the hard power arena. How important are the oceans to American national security? And based on your experience in the U.S. Navy and your time at NOAA, what can you tell us about how the oceans and the effective use of the marine environment keep America safe?
Well, there are many reasons for that and the importance of our oceans to national security, John. First and foremost, the marine transportation system. The simplest way that China can take over Taiwan is to blockade the island from shipping and restrict the incoming supplies, which the country, the island depends upon. And that's just one example, of course. Our own U.S. economy and security and prosperity depend upon the free flow of global trade. So our oceans are really the life, the circulation system of our livelihood. And so that's the marine transportation system. In terms of real, you know, force projection and defense, our main, I would say our main battery, to be honest with you, is our undersea forces, the submarine forces of the U.S. Navy. Because of the advantage they have in terms of their stealth, they are it's going to come down to in any major conflict that will be the force, along with our cyber forces, really hand in hand, and probably more in the future, so our space forces that will ensure our defense and our victory if called to go forward and fight downrange. And of course, that wasn't the nature in the last few decades in Iraq and Afghanistan with the different nature of terrorism and what was happening there. But now, though, with great power competition, China and Russia, I think that is a maritime domain. You see, we'd either be in the northern areas, the high north, as they call the Arctic region of Europe and where Russia is, or in the Western Pacific where China is. It's our undersea forces that will help us succeed. And that is interesting about that. So that's the ocean domain. And our undersea forces depend upon ocean science to succeed because of the nature of sonar and sound propagation in the water. It depends upon the density of the ocean, the salinity, and the pressure and temperature. So mapping and knowing the weather of the ocean, the inside of the ocean, is critical for submarine forces to prevail. And that was my job in the Navy, first and foremost. I forecasted weather on aircraft carriers, but I also provided that ocean weather to our undersea forces.
And you talked earlier about mapping the ocean floor. That's also critical for safe, effective submarine operations as well, knowing exactly what the depths are, where those seamounts are. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. There's a concept that was introduced by the famous explorer Robert Ballard, the discoverer of the Titanic, who's a great friend of mine. And if anybody wants to listen to a really great show, he was on my podcast about a year ago, and I interviewed him about his book. But he came up with the term seabed warfare because he was a marine geologist, and he was also a naval officer. And he understood the value of knowing the undersea terrain better than the enemy or the adversary. It's just like in ground warfare, where high ground provides a tactical advantage. You have the same idea, a concept in the oceans today. And this revolves around our increasing use of autonomous systems and a very nascent but developing undersea infrastructure to support them. In addition, when we think about information, and you mentioned that being one of four elements of national power, where does 90% of information flow occur? It's not through imaginary lightning bolts in space to satellites. It's undersea cables. And we saw a great example of this seabed warfare with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline getting destroyed up in the Baltic Sea, providing natural gas and oil to Europe from Russia. So with communications, with other undersea infrastructure, knowing our seabed and having an ability to operate and defend it better than the adversary, which requires intimate knowledge of the nature of that bathymetry and mapping it, that is really a key element of advantage in our national power.
Now, you mentioned China a little bit. I do want to cover a little bit more of China in the Indo-Pacific Command, but you brought up the undersea cables, submarine cables, communication cables. Interestingly enough, I've read many articles lately that some of these undersea cables off of Taiwan that connect Taiwan to the rest of the world randomly get cut by Chinese fishing vessels. So yeah. That's sort of this, the things, the harassment that goes on out there. And there was just a great article that came out that showed a Russian, quote-unquote, research vessel with guys on board who were decked out in balaclava hoods and automatic weapons. And that vessel transited through the Baltic and then out into the North Sea a bit, and visited a lot of the wind turbine generation, the at-sea wind turbine generation for electricity that the UK uses, relies heavily on. And so there's a great concern about what may have been happening with that quote-unquote research vessel. So is this the kind of, the undersea warfare, the seabed warfare that you were concerned about during your time as an admiral in the Navy and also, frankly, as acting administrator at NOAA?
Oh, absolutely, John. And you know, this is a former intelligence officer that those elements, either in Russia or China, they're not accidental, and they're purposely supported by the states, and that's just an extension of their offensive military capability.
Hybrid warfare, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. We have this term that we use in the Navy. It's called a choke point. Can you talk a little bit about the ocean's choke points and why they are so important in the study of oceanography and understanding where those choke points are, how they function, and how they impact how we think about using naval power, maritime power, as a result of those choke points?
Well, yes, you bet, John. In fact, I mentioned it earlier that the free flow of trade over our oceans is so critical for our national security and economic security. And there are these regions of the ocean where that trade, these shipping routes tend to be constrained and can easily be blocked because of their small area. And then we have a few of these around the world. The Straits of Malacca, the strait is over near in the Western Pacific. We have the Strait of Hormuz on the southern part of the Arabian Gulf, and where much of the world's oil supply transits through. And then and there are others too, but those are probably the two most well known. The Panama Canal is another, actually. And if any of those were to be blocked, and in fact, a great example last year or 2 years ago was the MV Ever Given, when it blocked the Red Sea, the Suez Canal.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I have somewhere here the Order of the Ditch. I've gone through there. That's the Navy way of recognizing you going through that small body of water. And when the Ever Given blocked it for several days, some serious economic impact. So, yes. So that's the point of ensuring choke points are open and accessible by global shipping, and they are therefore strategic in terms of keeping open and defending. And that was a big reason why the U.S. was so has had such a heavy Middle East presence. Is the Arabian Gulf was strategic to the world in terms of providing energy. And we were determined as a nation to keep that body of water open, and for those reasons.
So I know you spent time supporting both U.S. Indo-Pacific Command from an oceanography perspective, and you've worked on Arctic Ocean issues at NOAA and as the oceanographer of the Navy. Let's focus a little bit more on the Arctic, if we could. What are America's national security interests in the Arctic region, and how does oceanography support our security interests in that region? And how will climate change alter those security calculations specifically up in the Arctic?
Well, of course, John, thanks. In the Arctic, one of the critical considerations is our partnerships. Look at Canada and in the Baltic states, Finland, Norway, Sweden. These are critical allies for us. And you just saw Finland join NATO. Sweden's considering it. So I think one of the most important elements of Arctic national security is the partnerships there, which are very, very strong. And on the flip side is our relationship with Russia, which is at the most antagonistic it's ever been in the last half century, probably. And that's a very big concern, knowing that's a nuclear capable country and all the rhetoric coming out. Those are the sort of the yin and yang, the contrasting aspects of our national security posture in the Arctic. And so the stronger we can reinforce our alliances, and the more we can maintain an advantage over Russia, the better, which is a risky thing to do, again, because of their nuclear saber rattling that you hear. But I think ultimately, though, that's a place for opportunity. So the Arctic is changing the region, and there are some winners and losers, right? In Alaska, for example, thawing permafrost is having a serious impact on infrastructure up there, and that's a problem. But then again, when we see the increased growing season in the high north, that could potentially, for Russia especially, lead to economic gain. It's a shame that Russia has done what they've done in Ukraine. because if an objective person sat back and saw what was happening, Russia really stood to gain in the climate change arena, because if you look at the northern sea route in that region, not only would they see more shipping go through and potentially, and they've talked about potentially imposing fees for piloting it, et cetera, and making money off that, but also look at the geography of that region. If you were to take Russia's northern boundary and coastline and turn it upside down, it would look like the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, it would look like the Gulf of Mexico on steroids, because there's three major rivers that empty into it, like the Mississippi. So you have all this ocean continental shelf, which is stores vast supplies of natural gas. So Russia just really made a big strategic mistake in going after Ukraine instead of stepping back and capitalizing off the energy and all the other economic gain that can happen from that region warming.
Yeah, and the Russians have been investing in improving their port facilities up on the Arctic Ocean, and with climate change giving more access to those ports, maybe even year-round in the not-too-distant future, they can get in and start logging some of those massively huge forests, the taiga forest, up in that part of the world. That's another natural resource they can tap into, but that might be a little challenging for them going forward. Let me ask you this,
exactly.
Back to the Pacific Theater. I have a little Associated Press article here that talked about Japan ocean policy vows tougher security amid China threat. So Japan just recently adopted a five-year ocean policy plan. About a week ago now, the new basic plan on ocean policy is something that Japan has adopted. The policy is about their exclusive economic zone. It's about concerns from foreign quote unquote survey boats, Chinese fishing fleets, Chinese Coast Guard vessels, their maritime militia, etc., pressing Japan's territorial claims throughout the region. Are there other countries that are sort of moving more aggressively towards having these really well thought out, organized ocean policy plans that the U.S. can support?
Right. Well, yes, they're either in the works or other countries have already adopted them. And it's a lot of the Pacific Islands nations I've mentioned. And in various forms, they're adopting policies to, as Japan is doing, to counter China's negative influence. And as the U.S. has done as well, we did this during my time at NOAA. I was on the White House Ocean Policy Committee, and we issued forth every year policy statements on our use of the oceans and their role in our national, natural, and economic security. And other nations see that too. And that's really, again, why I, when I was at NOAA, had so much international engagement, capitalizing on those desires and interests in terms of advancing these other partner nations' ocean policies for their benefit. In fact, I mean, just to give you some examples, I sure earned frequent flyer miles when I was there. I went to I've been to New Caledonia, north of Australia, for a large scientific ocean conference. I've been to Tuvalu, a very small country, for an annual event called the Pacific Island Forum. And I went there with the Secretary of Interior, David Bernhardt. I've been to Hawaii for a big international conference that we called the PRIMO Conference, which was about promoting coastal resilience for all the Pacific Island nations. And I've met with presidents and prime ministers of Marshall Islands, the Cook Islands, American Samoa, Samoa. And then I've also met with senior officials in American Samoa. The list goes on and on. So the Pacific matters, and that's the point. And it did then, it does now. And those partnerships are really just key for our national security.
So you visited all these wonderful, idyllic paradise locations in the South Pacific. And why the heck are you living in Maryland?
Yeah, good point. Well, our family's nearby, my parents and my wife's parents. But we get back there as much as I can. Actually, I had been to Fiji as well. And Palau, the Republic of Palau, which is near the Philippines. Yep. At that time, this is kind of a neat example of the ocean and security. I was the chair of the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force. There was such a thing. And if that job sounds cool, it was. And my job was to promote and protect the conservation of American coral reefs and those of our partners. And we have a strong partnership with the Republic of Palau, as well as the Marshall Islands. And they were part of our task force. And we're adopting a number of national policies and creating them and refining them to, again, promote the health of coral reefs. Why does that matter? Well, the coral reefs are, first of all, they're national treasures in terms of their biodiversity. I've been diving all around the world, and I just never get tired of coral reef diving. But secondly, they're the nurseries of fisheries. And again, I mentioned fisheries being so economically important to us and our partners. Well, that's where fisheries really kind of originate and are sustained by. And then you also have this other important component of being barriers to inundation. So, for example, Florida's coral reef track system is critical to reducing the impact of storm surge from hurricanes. And so those benefits are really vast. And then as a coral reef diver, the tourism and recreation value of them is another one. So and in doing that, understanding that ocean health aspect of coral reefs, therefore using it as a diplomacy and security tool to partner with other nations like Palau. For example, Palau being where it is, it's China is working, has tried to invest in the island and has tried to really take it over America's role in being a preferred partner. And that Coral Reef Initiative, as well as a partnership that I initiated between our marine protected area, it's an underwater park basically, in American Samoa and the Republic of Palau, both have these protected areas. And I signed an agreement that the president of Palau signed where those two sanctuaries are now cooperating on coral reef conservation and science. And if anyone gets to the Pacific and has a chance to dive in Palau or American Samoa, do it, because those are like the redwood forests of coral. They're magnificent.
I agree. I was fortunate enough to dive the Blue Corner in Palau and around some of the Rock Islands. To this day, the only other place that even comes close was the Great Barrier Reef in Australia.
When did you do that?
While I was assigned in Japan. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, who's the former acting administrator of NOAA and the former oceanographer of the United States Navy. And we're discussing the oceans of the world and their importance to many aspects of American national security. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, we have about 11 minutes remaining in the show today. What investments should America be making right now in ocean sensing technologies to better equip ourselves for future challenges? What kind of technologies would commercial shipping, the U.S. Navy, the Coast Guard, and our allies and friends around the world benefit from if said technologies were fielded? In other words, funded by Congress and allied and friendly governments.
Right. Well, there's a number that exists now that I believe we should continue to fund. And they include both sort of fixed assets like moored buoys that are constantly measuring the ocean temperature, circulation, chemical composition. And these are operated by NOAA for research and for shipping, safe shipping and things like that. Then there's also an increasing fleet of autonomous vehicles and vessels, surface vessels. NOAA has several, and they're really transitioning all their ships to be mother ships of these uncrewed surface vessels. And that's really neat. And they're mapping the seafloor and also monitoring the ocean's conditions for research and for the marine shipping and benefits, and also the public safety benefits by predicting storm surges and hazardous weather, both at sea and along our coast. Increasingly, satellite, a remote sensing capability to measure the ocean. NOAA's moving forward to deploy some ocean color instruments on satellites. That helps monitor the health of oceans and fisheries. But I'll tell you right now, so all of that, drone technology, ships, satellites, aircraft. But of all those, what America really needs to invest in is people. Our youth and STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. Those are the people that will operate this to apply these technologies for the benefit of understanding our ocean, protecting it, and sustainable use of the ocean in the terms of its contribution to a blue economy. And it's people who have a education in the technology, in the science, and in the policy making aspects that those enable.
Is Congress going to need to think about funding improvements to American port infrastructure? I mean, even if we keep sea level rise to a foot, that's going to impact the port infrastructure. Is that something that we should be investing in now? I know at our alma mater, the Naval Academy, they just broke ground on a brand new seawall because they've been dealing with significant storm surges at king tides and whatnot. Is that something that should be funded? The port
infrastructure? I think so. And in fact, large investments have been made in our ports over the years. And I've been working with the American Association of Port Authorities to promote that exact message to Congress. I've been to that seawall project, by the way, because Annapolis is not very far from where I live. And I've seen the flooding there too that was occurring and reason for that project. So those projects are occurring, and I do believe those investments are necessary because of their incredible contribution to our economy. U.S. seaports, I think in 2018, contributed to one-third of our GDP. It was something on the order of $5.6 trillion. We are a maritime nation, and our seaports are the lifeblood of our economy.
And that goes back to the founding of our country. The Northeast was the heart of our maritime economy. So, Dr. Gallaudet, we've covered a lot of ground this morning. Let me ask you two final things. What do you see happening with regard to the ocean environment that deeply concerns you? And then on the flip side of that, what do you see happening that truly inspires you about for the future of the oceans, protecting the oceans and anything else with regard to the oceans?
Well, first, thank you, John, for having me. It's great to be on your show. I like what you're doing, and I love that you're giving this message about national security to your audience. And I'm actually not overly concerned about all the harm that's being done by the ocean, because I've seen a sea change in the public's understanding and attitude towards the ocean. In the last decade, for example, funding for ocean conservation has doubled to nearly $2 billion, and that's only increasing right now. So I'm part of a number of nonprofits and other efforts that are addressing ocean conservation, and I've just seen a major shift in America's attitude towards the ocean. People want to protect it. They love sea life, even if they don't live near the ocean. And so that is encouraging, and I'm on a campaign to promote more of it. My biggest concern is as we talked about, it's China, because they don't share our values towards the ocean. And you see all the harm they're doing to it: illegal fishing, marine plastic pollution, greenhouse gas emissions that are far outstrip ours. And all of those are contributing to damages, which we've already talked about. And so I think the more that we can influence other nations to partner with us and in time do influence China for the same, then therefore the benefits to our ocean and to our society at large.
So there's a lot of value in the soft power side of sharing of information and economic engagement and helping a lot of these partner nations all across the world who have significant investments or rely heavily on the oceans to make sure that we are looking out for them, the little guy, so to speak, partnered up with them. Is that something you would advocate for, that soft power
engagement?
Absolutely.
Yes, I absolutely do. I think that's just critical going forward. And if we care about our ocean and our national, natural, and economic security, then increasing the partnerships we have with our Pacific Island and other coastal states, the better. And I'm pleased that we are doing that, regardless of administration, by the way. I think, and I like the fact that's a bipartisan, really apolitical issue of being a better partner to nations like that.
Let me put you on the spot. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. You and I are both career naval officers. I think we agree that convention is actually really helpful for the Navy, for the Coast Guard, for our partner nations, partners around the world. Should the U.S. Senate finally ratify that?
Absolutely. I've said so during hearings and congressional hearings and in public. As you know, it's a long story for our audience, but ultimately there's a small group in Congress who think that citing to an international convention like this would somehow infringe upon our sovereign status and ability to be independent as a nation. And I think, you know, the days of that kind of isolationism are over. We're too globally connected to think like that.
Yeah. So a couple last questions before we have to end our show. I believe you have a book coming out next year. Could you tell us a little bit about that book? What was the catalyst for it, and what's the title?
Yeah, thanks for asking, John. I have a book coming out next year. It's my story, if you will, and from the Navy to my time at this ocean agency, NOAA. And it's called Holding Fast in Heavy Seas, Leading America's Top Ocean Agency in Turbulent Times. And it's really a book about leadership. I don't tell everything in my story, if you will. It's not a memoir, but I share how I learned lessons in leadership by my naval service. And then when I came to NOAA, it was leading an agency and being a political appointee are very different aspects of my service compared to what I did in the Navy. And trying to keep, the ship sailing on an even course and an even keel, straight course and even keel, was sometimes not easy. And I just tell the story of exactly that, trying to stay true to my leadership ethic of service while serving at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Do you have a release date for that book yet?
I don't. I'm still working with two potential publishers, and I'm hoping it'll come out in the spring of 2024.
Okay. We'll be looking for that. You also have a podcast you mentioned a little bit, the American Blue Economy. Can you tell us just a little bit more about that podcast? And are you on a mission to educate people about the blue economy?
Well, I wouldn't call it a mission, but it's something I enjoy and have fun with. And so this American Blue Economy podcast, it treats a number of aspects of our ocean, coastal, and Great Lake-based economies. And from this, I discuss science, I discuss people and education. I go into a number of different aspects of the local economies, for example, like dive tourism, and scuba dive tourism, or fisheries, etc. It's just really what I do that for is fun. I have a great network of people I work with across my career, and it's just a great way to stay in touch with them and hear about what they're doing. My last few episodes have been about technologies and their contributions to ocean and coastal economies, like uncrewed systems, like satellites, and have a few episodes on scuba diving and dive tourism. And I had a Robert Ballard, the discoverer of Titanic, on one of my shows. So where ocean technologies and exploration technologies that he pioneered, how they contribute to now our marine economy and transportation system. So it's just something I have fun with. And if people care about the ocean and how we use it sustainably, give it a shot.
And it's called The American Blue Economy. I'm assuming people can find out any of the major podcast services.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
So, Admiral, we're down just a couple minutes. I always try to give my guests the final word. What thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners regarding the oceans of the world? What is it you have learned about the oceans, their importance to life on our planet, their nexus to national security, et cetera, throughout your career in the U.S. Navy and your time as the acting administrator at NOAA?
Thanks, John. It's great to be here and a great question. To me, the oceans are our greatest resource. Space is interesting, and I know as a society, we're moving back to go to the moon and Mars, and that is brilliant and wonderful. And all the technology spinoffs that NASA has provided have been great for our nation and for the world. However, we still have an inner space in the world's oceans that's largely unexplored and undiscovered. And we already know, for what we know it's incredibly beautiful and diverse and sustaining in terms of the natural resources the ocean provides. So I encourage everyone to look under the hood and try to learn more about our world's oceans.
Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, you're CEO of Ocean STL Consulting. Where can people find the website for your company?
Ocean STL, and you'll Google it and you'll get it.
All right. Tim Gallaudet, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great discussion.
Thanks, John. It's great what you're doing. Keep it up.
All right. Folks, that closes this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today here on KYMN Radio. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.